is something that can be taught to a degree, but you also kind of have to bring your own personality to that as well.
Hello, listener, and welcome to episode 84 of Good Copy, Bad Copy, the B2B copywriting podcast. This month, we're talking about getting the best out of creative people when you're producing your content. As you can hear, we're still recording under lockdown conditions, so apologies if the audio isn't great, but we can promise you a great episode, including a very special interview with a conductor, Alice Farnham. I'm David Maguire, Creative Director at Radix Communications, and our guest co-host this episode is the fabulous Harry Kapoor, Head of Writing at Velocity Partners. Hi, Harry.
Hi. I've never been called fabulous before.
Have you not?
No, liar. I don't think so. I think at best someone called me fantastic sarcastically. I don't think I got a genuine fabulous. This is great.
You hang out in the wrong bars.
Probably. Sounds like me.
So how are you doing? How's everything? How's the apocalypse treating you?
Good. You know, I mean, it's always important to like remind yourself that like in this apocalypse, in these unprecedented dark times, we definitely have it easiest. I think the people, those of us who are doing marketing, I also feel like long term, it's probably, for those of us in tech and, that kind of sphere, I think enough tech companies now understand and enough SaaS companies understand that marketing is a really important thing and actually not the biggest piece of their customer acquisition cost. And so even long term, I feel like it's probably a decent place that we're in where we're super, 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 super lucky. And at the same time, it's an apocalypse. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know,
that's the thing. I always feel like when people ask, how are you? I'm always conscious that in the scheme of things, I have very little to complain about.
Yeah.
But, like, I miss being at work. I miss my gang. I miss seeing everybody's faces, you know?
I had this weird thing the other day where I was like, I really miss going to the stationery cupboard and hoping it'll have the pen I need and then finding out it doesn't have the pen I need. Like, that specific thing is all I want. Yeah.
Absolutely. Like, yeah. I joined Radix so that you know there would be people around and I'd get to work with a team, and you know Zoom and things are great, but it's not the same as sitting in the room with someone and doing the
it's really not. I mean, it's sort of like you spend all your time with this group of idiots. I mean, this is an agency thing, and I guess why like also this is going to be such an interesting thing for us to get into, that like you spend all your time with these idiots and you are an idiot with them, and that's the whole job, is just being idiots together for ages and ages. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, now you could just be idiots but like remotely. It isn't even close to the same kind of idiocy. I think that you'd get any other way. So there's something weird about it. I do find myself, I have to catch myself a lot saying, don't wait for it to be over. Like I don't know when it will be over. And so I feel like that's also an important thing to remember, is like, just assume it's going to be 6 months. And like, what would you do if it was 6 months? Feels like the right course of action for right now. I don't know.
Yeah. Listener, as always, we do want to hear from you too. Harry, do you want to do the honors and tell them where they can contact the show with their thoughts, comments, abuse?
Sure thing. You can email the show on podcast@radix-communications.com, or you can find Radix on Twitter at radixcom. That's RADIXCOM.
Sure. It's a hyphen in the middle. copywriters.
Well, I don't. These are not the things.
Nonetheless, nicely done, sir. Thank you.
Cool. Thank you. Thank you. So David and I have pretty similar jobs in the sense that we both manage groups of people, and our whole aim is to get the best creative output from them. This is a weird process because we're not managing creative people for the purposes of making art. We're trying to get them to hit these really specific briefs and these weird deadlines, and for them to use their creative abilities in this really specific kind of context. Now, David and I would talk about this, and we're like, oh, that'd be a cool thing to talk about. And then David had an amazing idea. He was like, we should talk to someone else who has to do this, but that doesn't have the exact same job you and I have. And so he came up with something I didn't think he would, which is to talk to an orchestra conductor. And yeah. So I'm really excited about this episode.
Yeah, no, it was great. I'm really delighted. So I spoke with Alice Farnham. Earlier this year, Alice was rated by Classic FM as one of the 5 best female conductors alive.
Amazing.
She studied in St. Petersburg. She's conducted all over the world, you know, Royal Opera House, National Ballet. Now she's developing a new generation of conductors. So she's Artistic Director of Women Conductors at the Royal Philharmonic Society and the National Concert Hall in Ireland. So naturally, I was pretty blown away when I contacted her on Twitter and said, do you fancy having a chat about B2B marketing? And she said yes. So I started by asking her whether she sees any parallels between running an orchestra and answering a brief as a B2B content team.
Yeah, it's actually very similar. And I find what's really interesting about the parallels that we people often find there are parallels in the business world and all sorts of things, because it really is this area where you have this incredibly talented group of individuals in an orchestra, and they've got the music on the page as well, so they really basically know what they're doing. And the truth is that actually an orchestra, particularly an orchestra that plays a lot together all the time, they will be able to do it without a conductor, if we're really honest, a lot of the time, depending on the piece and the size of the orchestra sometimes. But it's really about sort of bringing, I think anyway, it's about bringing out the best of them and bringing out that sort of individuality within the orchestra, but at the same time having a sort of coherence and a sort of vision of what you want as well, which is also needed, because in something like a symphony or an opera, there are many ways within this sort of strict limits that you have on the page. There are actually many subtle differences and ways that you can do something, and somebody needs to kind of make those decisions.
And so when you're getting towards that process and that vision, is that something, does that vision come from you, or is that collaboratively with the orchestra or certain key people within the orchestra? How do you arrive at that?
Actually, I think it's all of the above, really, because there are moments. So when you're preparing a piece, when I'm at home and I've got the scores and I'm looking through them and learning them and getting my own idea of how I would like it to go, maybe listening to lots of recordings and forming my own vision of it and my own ideas for it, then I come to meet the orchestra and the sort of sound they make will make me react slightly differently, perhaps. And also, I think there is, I mean, traditionally, there's a lot of sort of ignorance around what a conductor really does. And there's a lot of this sort of mystical thing, not just from the layman, but actually from musicians themselves, of sort of, you know, why are some conductors fantastic and why are others not so good? And I think actually I think there's an enormous amount of collaborative work that should go on for conductors. And of course, you know, I find if I'm working on a symphony and a flautist has a wonderful solo and she plays it in a certain way, that I think, yeah, great, we go with that. It completely makes sense. I wouldn't necessarily want to impose my idea, which would be contrary to that. So it's a very subtle mix of all those things. And the problem is sometimes we don't have the time to really develop that as well. That's one of the restrictions that we often have.
And is that kind of, you kind of work that out with them through a rehearsal process? Do you have kind of limited time for that, do you? Or?
Yeah, we have very limited time, particularly in this country, actually. The British performers are some of the fastest readers in the world. Because we have to be, because the musicians have very little rehearsal time. So they, you know, just have to get things right first time. So there's often a limit to that. There's also orchestras really don't like conductors that talk too much, understandably, And actually, that's where you come into the area that I do a lot of work on, and I do a lot of teaching of this, is the whole sort of fact that it's really a visual art, and it's all about, it's like mime, really, and you're showing what you want to these players. So you have to have a technique that can embody a huge amount with your hands, so that you don't need to say very much, and you can a player will immediately understand what you want from a gesture, which is a very difficult thing, and is something that can be taught to a degree, but you also kind of have to bring your own personality to that as well.
Is there an element of sort of leadership within that, and where that's a two-way, that communication is a two-way thing, right? You know, you can have the best gestures and things in the world, but they have to respect you enough to pay attention to that, right?
Absolutely, yeah. You absolutely hit the nail on the head there. Yeah, I think, and that's why it's particularly hard for young conductors with very little experience. You know, they'll practice and they'll learn all this wonderful, beautiful gestures, and they'll come to an orchestra and they'll do it, and it just won't work for whatever reason. That might not necessarily be their fault. It might be the orchestra have just decided they hate that conductor for whatever reason. They generally hate conductors anyway, so which is sort of understandable. But so yes, and with experience you come to realize, okay, so this isn't working with them, I need to do it, I need to adapt. And the more experienced you become, the quicker you can quickly change your gestures to sort of get through to them. And also then, of course, you have to combine that with saying things. So, you know, you might be showing something, but actually they're not quite, you know, maybe they're focused, they're reading the page too much, and they're not really necessarily looking quite enough. Because bearing in mind, all their looking, almost all of it, is done through peripheral vision. There's very little absolute direct eye contact for very long periods of time, because they're too busy looking at the page. So they're also, and they're also listening to their players, responding to, and you know, responding to everything they're hearing around them, and also seeing the way the other players are breathing, which will help inform them. So their peripheral vision and ears is you know, on at an incredibly sophisticated level. And also the conductors as well should be the same, you know, constantly thinking, who needs my help? What do I need to show? Where do I need to show that? And so, yeah, it's a very multitasking area.
So if it's an orchestra that you don't know well, that's kind of a process of adapting and kind of earning their respect as you go, rather than a sense of innate presence or something, or is there an element of that as well? And can that be taught?
Yeah, well, is it very interesting? Because I think, one of the things I talk about a lot with my students, and particularly because I almost exclusively teach women, just because of, you know, this program that these programs that I've been running. So one of the things we work on, and I actually teach alongside a woman, well, there's a couple of women I work with who teach acting to singers, and we work on the fact that it is true, and this is true all over the world with a professional orchestra, that the orchestra will decide whether they like you or not before you've even started conducting. Basically, the minute you stand on the podium, they'll basically have made a decision. You could reverse that decision, but it's going to be a lot harder if you don't make a really good impression at the beginning. And that impression, you know, the idea and the mistake that a lot of young conductors might fall into is to pretend to be, you know, they might be 25, but they try and act like they're 60, or, you know, be very pompous or something. And, you know, players are going to hate them even more for doing that. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of it's a really tough call. So what I work on a lot is giving a air of confidence without a sort of a defensiveness, you know, of like, I'm in charge kind of thing, but much more welcoming, and an air of confidence that you're glad to be there and that you want to work with these people. And that can be done by, you know, a sort of element of acting in a sincere way, if you see what I mean. But, you know, but particularly because when you meet an orchestra for the first time, I mean, I've been doing this for many years now, and I still, when I meet, particularly when I meet a new orchestra I've never met before, I am so nervous. The concert is the easy bit. The first rehearsal with a new orchestra is still really nerve-wracking, and I don't think I'll ever have a time when that won't be really, really nerve-wracking.
Can you get, I mean, with experience, can you get it back if that goes badly? Or if that first rehearsal goes badly, are you in for a tough time?
I think it's really hard. Yeah, I think you can be in for a tough time. I mean, I think you also have to develop a very thick skin, or at least if you don't have a thick skin, because I'm not sure I have a particularly thick skin, but you just learn, okay, so there's that second clarinetist that looks like he wants to murder me. I've just got to ignore him, you know. Okay, I know that this makes me feel bad, but not everyone is going to like me. I can never, you know. And you sort of have to develop, you know, ways of dealing with that. I think there's also the flip side of this thing, and what I really work with on is trying to get these women, they're not necessarily young women, but they're, some of them are new to conducting or afraid of conducting, even though they have the necessary skills to do it. I, you know, work a lot on them giving this confidence. But where I think there's an area, and I don't know whether this is something in the business world that might be much better, but it's also about how people respond to conductors, and particularly young conductors, because there has been, in decades gone by, less so now, but there was a real bullying of conductors of players, and it still happens amongst some of the famous conductors. It's less and less acceptable. So conductors tend to be, and particularly in this country, Scandinavia, America, you know, some countries have a more reputation. For example, in Germany, the conductors there tend to be expected to behave more aggressively. But I think because there's been these for so long, there's been this sort of bullying of conductors towards players, that the tables have turned a bit, and I think actually now players can really bully conductors in a way. They have a lot of power. They decide, you know, they will fill in a survey after a guest conductor has come, and they'll decide, and they will, that survey, the managers of the orchestra will think very carefully about whether they have this conductor back, depending on what these players have said about them. So they have a lot of power, but I think that there should be some work done at the student level right the way up about this whole thing, about the conductors respecting the players and understanding that it's a collaboration, but also players understanding the difficulties of the conducting job. I think we need to do more of that, actually, and I would love to sort of be involved in that kind of thing.
With the kind of the female conductor program, that kind of thing, you've kind of been through sort of Myers-Briggs profiling and that kind of thing. Are there personality types that lend themselves to leading creative people like that?
Or? Well, it was very interesting because this is a wonderful program that I'm leading at the National Concert Hall in Dublin, and it's sponsored by Grant Thornton, and they very much, we've been running it now, this is the second iteration of it, and they very much wanted to be involved in it and in the training of these aspiring conductors. And so they have been running throughout the year, they've been running sort of leadership courses from people from their business, from the business community. And it won an award, actually, Arts to Business, or Business to Arts, I'm not quite sure, it was one way around the other, for Ireland. And it won the top prize because of that collaboration between and finding these parallels. And there was a wonderful, we did this, it was just a few weeks ago, we did this session on understanding self and others. And we have, I don't know, I've done one of those Myers-Briggs things for, I think, for a job many years ago, but I don't know what the result was. I didn't get the job, so obviously So obviously my thing wasn't right, but this was with these different the different colours. I don't know if that's normal sort of categorization of it. So it was blue, green, orange and gold, or whether that's specific to this the woman that was running it.
I don't know. That sounds like it might be disc profiling, but I'm...
Yeah. Basically, I'm it's, sure. You know, what type of leader are you? And there are four different types of leader. And it was really interesting because I came out as... three of them, I came out as they were almost exactly the same. The one that came out the highest was the sort of natural problem solver, responding quickly and efficiently in a crisis, a strong sense of reality and ability to see opportunities, making you an excellent negotiator, being able to verbalize appreciation, and be a source of, and that would help you be a source of encouragement to staff, and welcoming and seeking change, and always running a flexible, dynamic, and performance oriented organization. And it's sort of living in the here and now, must have freedom. I welcome change and taking risks and like variety. See fun and performance and deal quickly with concrete problems, and flexible and practical and diplomatic. I think those are all really, I have to say, even though this, I'm being biased about my own type of personality, but I think they're really good for a conductor. I think the risk taking is sort of essential, the sense of fun, but also being able to quickly react to things, very, very quickly, sort of thinking on your feet on the podium, being, you know, able to react if the orchestra aren't responding to what you're wanting, that kind of thing. But the other two were also pretty high. You know, I had a sort of you know, valuing personal relationships and a sort of family orientated group, and I think a lot of conductors don't necessarily have that actually, but I think it's quite good, valuing harmony and cooperation, having a sort of intuition, and maybe over reading people a little bit and perhaps being oversensitive. That was a sort of weakness that I was saying that I noticed that I have when I sort of worry a bit too much about things. But the area where I scored very low really surprised me, because it was sort of not really necessarily liking punctuality or order or procedure. And actually, those are all things that I find absolutely set. I mean, punctuality, you know, your orchestra will walk out if you go over 3 hours. They will stop playing immediately. You know, and if you arrive late, you will never work there again. It's simple as that. Punctuality... structure, detail, those are incredibly important, but I don't think they necessarily come naturally to me, but I sort of really need them, and I think a conductor really needs them. So it's an interesting sort of area, actually.
But it sounds like those things are kind of a given. Those things are kind of the table stakes that you need, you know, that they just have to be there. And then the way that the kind of the way that you do the job, you know, the way that you express yourself in the job is more to do with those other things. I'm interested just to pick up with the element of wanting people to feel like a family and harmony, and clearly being very interested in the people that you work with.
Yeah.
And I wonder if either that, or for less experienced conductors, the sense that they are, well, the reality that they are going to be rated by the orchestra. Is there a temptation with that when it comes to allowing the players to have creative freedom? Is there a temptation to let them get away with too much so that they will like you more?
I think that's absolutely true. I think that is very, very true. And I think some of the most successful conductors, not, I wouldn't even say necessarily the best, but the ones with the biggest careers, and, you know, deserved careers as well. I'm not saying that they're not doing a good job, but they're often the ones that don't have that at all, actually. They know what they want, and they don't really care that much. You know, it doesn't make them nasty, or it doesn't mean that they don't have respect for the people around them, but they're not particularly concerned by that, and they certainly don't care whether people like them or not. They're usually the most successful.
So you need to kind of sometimes sort of disengage from that. I mean, is there room in the process for, you know, a bit of disobedience and that kind of thing? Or is it something where, you know, because you have such limited time, you have the, you know, you have the music on the sheet, you know, and you have so many other people combine with, is it something where there isn't really room for people to mess around a bit?
I think there is room, but I think it's a fine line, isn't it? It's that sort of thing of if you sort of, it's a bit like, I mean, it's very like a teacher, I suppose. You know, we can all remember those teachers at school that where you could muck around a little bit, but you knew that there was a point where you would never go beyond because you just knew you wouldn't try it on. Whereas there were other teachers who were very, very nice, actually, that you just sort of saw blood, really, as a child and would kind of, you know, even the nicest of us, I remember sort of we all reduced a teacher to tears. I can't think why we did that. She was absolutely lovely, you know, but you wouldn't have done that with another teacher that just, you know, who was equally nice, but somehow you knew how not to step over that mark.
When you're teaching and coaching up-and-coming conductors, is there a way that they can do that? Is there a way that they can set those boundaries, either in an implicit or explicit way?
Yes, I think probably not in an explicit way. I mean, I think, you know, generally orchestral players are very, very disciplined, certainly in this country. It does vary from country to country, actually, but certainly here they are incredibly disciplined, and ultimately they'll disobey you by very subtly ignoring what you're actually doing with your gestures, you know, but it won't be them sort of shouting back at you. And there might be sort of sniggers going on, but it's not going to be something explicit that you know, they won't walk out or they you know, they're incredibly professional in that way. So I think that the way around it I still find this, because, you know, I can still come up against difficulties in this way. I find that, you know, enthusiasm for the music is one of the things that they'll buy into, whether they agree with your vision or not. They'll just think, well, you know, they're just loving this. That's very infectious and gives them a kind of authority. And enthusiasm and just knowing it really well, knowing your music, knowing your score really, really well, those things, but also not lecturing, showing that you have respect for them, saying as little as possible, but what you say being very pertinent. I think that's the best way of getting around it. But it's a tough thing, not for the faint-hearted.
Thanks again, Alice, for being so generous with your time and your wisdom. Harry, what did you make of what she had to say?
So, like, the craziest thing to me is her job is exactly the same as our job. like everything she said, I was like, that's exactly what I go through. And, like, the way you were talking to her, I was like, oh, man, this is the same job, and it's nothing like it. It's completely different. So I'm just riveted by that.
Yeah, I think one of the things that really sort of resonated with me was, you know, the idea of the tension where, because you care about the people that you work with and you believe in them,
yeah,
you kind of want to give them more creative freedom than perhaps sometimes you should.
That's right. And it's the funniest thing, because, like, now I'm getting to the point where I'm trying to train some of them in training other people, and all the imposter syndrome that's bringing, because,
oh my god, yeah,
who am I? so, like, part of the thing with, I think, conveying that kind of, how do you get that kind of authority from these people that you're working with? And the fact that that's exactly the challenge that she's having between her as a conductor and them as an orchestra, and that there's this kind of power play in a way between the two of give and take, is so exactly the same job. It's crazy to me.
It's so mad. Although I am slightly worried about the idea of saying less in order to have more authority. I don't know about you, but talking less is not a thing that I'm great at. I really can't.
I've lost track of how many times I've been in a meeting with someone saying stuff to them and then going, oh, you went too far. Like, all of the last 40 seconds was completely unnecessary. Like, at 10 seconds, it was amazing. And then you just continued, you idiot.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like.
But I guess kind of the idea of getting authority through enthusiasm and knowing your stuff, though, that sounds like something that really resonates for anyone that's kind of leading a content team or leading a creative team.
That's
B2B.
Right. Because, I feel like the enthusiasm thing is about, like, it being a genuine connection with something outside of both of you, that like this is about this thing and this thing being great, and like as long as the two of us love the idea of this thing being great, it like nothing else really matters. It's just both of us like trying to get to this place, and that's kind of what you want to get to. You know, the thing that I find interesting in terms of that, like, how do I get people to this place where they're doing these things that they need to do that are hard for them, right? Like, they're not going to like this. They're not going to like this conversation I'm about to have with them. They're not going to like this brief I'm about to give them right now. But once they do it, once we have the conversation, everything's going to be gravy, right? And so, like, how do I get them to kind of, like, want to do that difficult thing? There's a wonderful expression that I've heard from, I think it's Dick Costolo, used to run this CEO class in Silicon Valley, and he calls it migrating up the y-axis, where basically you have two axes. One is how clear your communication is as a manager, and really that's the only thing that matters, that's the only thing anyone cares about. And then you have the other axis on top, the y-axis, which is towards, like, how happy are they? What, like, are they smiling when you're telling them right? Or are they feeling kind of bad that you've told them this thing? And because we're human beings, we all migrate up the y-axis. Whenever we tell someone something, we're trying so hard to please them with what we're saying that we lose sight of what we actually needed to say to them. And it's such an insanely difficult thing to, like, have to get over, but fundamental to everything that they do in their job as communicators themselves, but also, like, we have to overcome ourselves as managers, which I find,
And that was, you know, something that I think Alice was saying, you know, about where this getting over this need to be liked, you know, this people pleasing, because what people want is for you to be really clear about what you want them to do.
A lot of
the time. And that thing about where you're almost apologizing for the feedback that you're giving or the brief that you're giving is counterproductive.
And I think about, like, some of our clients and the kind of situation they might be in where they're trying to manage creativity out of whatever talent they've got at their disposal, for some of these purposes, like if they're trying to make something themselves, or even if they're just trying to have, like, a creative intuition about whatever it is they're working on with a partner like us. But, like, if you're in that kind of situation where you know you aren't a creative person, you have a good sense that the people you're dealing with don't really think about creativity in the terms that, like, your agency friends do or whatever. If you're trying to deal with that problem, on top of that, you've got this thing of, I don't want to sound horrible and tell them their idea sucks. Like, that must be insanely difficult to do. Whereas, like, for us, we could be like, that's just bad writing. I can give you 9 reasons why. Like, we can get to what the thing is. So, it's definitely the hardest thing. And I'm weirdly happy that Alice finds it hard too. Like, it's weirdly relieving. It's not just us.
The thing I find interesting is thinking of the process of conducting and working with an orchestra as a creative thing and giving a, you know, the example that she used was a flautist, you know, giving them room to be creative within, you know, you're with however many, you know, how many people in orchestra, 80 people or something, tons of other people, you know, using a piece of music that was probably written by a dead composer hundreds of years ago that everyone in the audience already knows, and you need to play the right notes in the right order. And within that, you can still be creative. And I think that for me sums up a lot of what this is, where people talk about creativity, they think it's about putting a scribble on a blank piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes for me, it's about having a very, very clear box to work within.
And to break as well. I mean, like, I, you know, that thing of The flautist's route to disobedience isn't to stand up and storm out of the room. It's to gently ignore what the conductor's asking them to do when they disagree. You know, that like this isn't the right, which is, you know, it's such a dignified, graceful kind of discord that you would hope to get in an orchestra. It is a really interesting thing. And I think a lot of it is I think the misunderstanding around what creativity is, I think stems from this idea of like, creativity is this kind of tube you can squeeze on and then magic comes out. When what creativity really is, and like, I know this, I'm sure you know this, and everyone in your team knows this as well, is like, creativity is insane. Creativity is chaos. It's being a crazy person for a living. It's like, I'm going to have ideas about things that aren't my business, is basically what we do for a living. It's an insane person's kind of thing to go down. And like, managing that kind of craziness so that the craziness doesn't hurt too much, but hurts just enough that you get the good ideas. It's like, it's all kind of this like stumbling, feeling around in the dark kind of a thing. And so what I find interesting in that context of like conducting, with this group of people is I really thought the conductor controlled everything, but that point Alice made about like, no, they decide. Like when you're on stage, they're deciding. They're going to do what they're going to do. And like, it doesn't matter what gesture you made, right? Like all that matters is that they made that song. And this is what the song sounds like now. And like that leverage that the musicians have over them, over the conductor is riveting to me, because like the tension that that's going to breed of like, you've got to do what I'm telling you to do. But at the same time, you hold the keys to disobeying me whenever you want to. Like, I think that's why they make great music, is because there's that tension, because there's that defined box that you can then break. I don't know. Do you find yourself like asking people to break stuff a lot?
No. I think the thing is, it's having that space, you know, where for me, it's about having the limits clearly defined. It's having the problem clearly defined. Mm. And then it's, okay, within this, we need to get to there. How do you do that? And for me, I think that for a lot of people, particularly people maybe that are less experienced, but it's almost, if you don't give them enough structure, they can't start to be creative.
That's it.
Whereas
that's
if you
it.
Give them a problem to solve that's very clearly defined, they can come up with brilliantly creative answers to that problem.
Correct.
But you have to ask them the right question.
Yeah. I used to work with this guy who was a biz dev guy in the first agency I worked at, and he used to come in and bring us open briefs all the time. Like he'd just come in, he'd be, oh, client has no idea what the internet is. Just anything. Give them anything. And we'd be like, what? Like, why do you keep doing this to us, man? And he's like, I thought that's what you wanted. He's like, I thought you're creative people and you'll come up with whatever you want. And we were like, no, rules. Give us rules. Give us something to break. Like, I need something. Like, I need something within which to, run and play and mess around with stuff, and test assumptions rather than, oh yeah, it could be whatever, man. Like, that's not creativity to me.
So, you know, you're at Velocity, you know, and you guys are known for, you know, particularly, you know, in the B2B sphere, particularly edgy content, creative thinking.
Yeah.
So do you end up, is it easier for you to get away with being creative, or do you get more that situation where the expectations are so high and you're kind of saying, we just, you know, give us more direction?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I definitely don't want to ignore the fact that because we're a little bit known for this, the people who are coming through the door generally are asking us to break stuff, right? Like they're asking us to be different. And, you know, just this week, been working with a company who very explicitly said, we tried really hard to do this ourselves and we sounded like everyone else. You have to make sure we sound like no one else. And we're like, all right. Fine, if that's what you want, man. Well,
it's a trap when a client says that.
Well, because we do have this, and I think in B2B in particular, we're like, you don't want to be so wacky and out there that it confuses your buyer, because like the nature of the buyer is so different than it is in B2C. Well, like actually confusing a B2C buyer, pretty nice experience, you know, if someone does a campaign and it kind of intrigues you and mystifies you. If a B2B guy, you know, puts a thing up with a bunch of buzzwords on it and you don't understand what it is, you ignore it, right? Like that's what happens. And so in our job, I don't know, I feel like as much as people are asking to be different, our instincts will always drag us to status quo. And well, no, that does sound like the other people. And that's why I know it's good, right? Because it sounds like all those other people and I'm part of this herd. That instinct always exists. And so I don't think it gets easier for us to convince clients. I even though we have the reputation and that's great. At the end of the day, it's the same. It's always scary. And it needs to always be a little scary.
Yeah. So what is the process? How do you manage that? I mean, cause I feel that, you know, you see as a full service agency, you see more of the end to end of the brief than we do as copywriters.
I'm going to say something that's kind of like a cliche in agency places, but like it really, a lot of people say that it's about the people. And for me, doubling down on the people means I need to make them into disagreeable, disobedient, ready to break stuff and try stuff, you know, courageous to a fault, kind of people. And live with the fact that I've made them into these disagreeable people.
You so know, how like do you
I
do that?
Like, that's the starting point. So I think, it's in the way we interact with each other. There's always, what's always baked into it is our own opinions about things. So for instance, I had a little bit of turnover and then brought some new people in. All of a sudden I had a very different looking team and the dynamic was strange enough that people weren't like talking to each other. They just weren't engaging with each other. And I was like, you're copywriters. How do you not have opinions? This is insane to me. And so I would just sit them in this room and I was like, it's called an editorial meeting, whatever. And we would just exchange like the best thing we've seen that week and the worst thing we've seen that week. And when you give someone that brief, it's super straightforward for them. They're like, well, this was clearly the worst thing I've seen this week. 19 reasons why, and then they'll just go on that. And so that kind of fostered within us a freedom to say, that's stupid, I hate it, here's why, and really justify why we're, and be cognizant always of that, like, okay, my judgment here matters because someone who is smart and I respect might disagree with me. And so what would that look like in this room? Like, how would that conversation go down? And so I think it's a million little things like those editorial meetings. And it's just always reminding them within interactions that, like, I'm going to tell you how to do this thing the best I can. You have to know that's not a good enough way to do it and break it and make it better, right? Like, that's always, always the job. Like, make me useless is always the game we're playing. And, like, so there's a little bit of, in a way, it's interspersed in all those millions of interactions, I guess. But the outcome you're aiming for is, like, does this person speak up and share how they really feel about stuff more often than not? That's the game you're trying to play.
That's exactly it. Because I think that, you know, our culture is quite different. I think, you know, that it's a bit less about being disagreeable, it's a bit less about breaking things. But still, it's about that moment where you can, oh God, I sound like Harry Potter. It's like, it's a difference between doing what's right and doing what's easy. You know?
Yes, that's it.
And it's that thing, that is that bit where somebody, you know, maybe quite a junior writer will turn and go, I think we could do this. I think there's a problem in this brief. Rather than just, I've been given this work, I'm going to do the work. You know, or going back to the account manager and saying, look, okay, I know, I see the deadlines and I know that we're making things tight, but if I can spend an extra 2 hours on this, it's going to be really good. And the client's going to really love it. You know, or it's that thing where, you know, it's picking up. Sometimes it's picking up the phone to you, picking up the phone to another client, you know, picking up the phone to someone and saying, you know, I'm looking at this brief and this bit doesn't make sense to me. You know, it's that bit of just being willing to speak up and being able to go,
just being allowed to have an opinion that that this isn't necessarily the way we should be doing this thing. I think from a company's point of view, the only thing you can really do is give people that permission and like keep reminding them you have that permission here. What you want them to be willing to do at some point is to feel comfortable with, I could say this and be wrong and still be okay. Like, if that's clear, amazing. Then I'll be able to do that. And like the example you took of like being on a call with a client and like there's something in this brief I disagree with. That in a way is the scariest thing to so many creatives.
It's
and by the way,
yeah.
I'm sure it's the scariest thing to a lot of people on client side to be on a phone with a bunch of agency people who've like studied design and stuff and to say, you know, well, I don't like blue. You know, it must be a little bit like, okay, what are these people going to say to me? I'm sure it's scary for a lot of those guys as well. But like the nature of this job is such that you have to be willing to have that conversation to do good work, right? Like stuff that is effective. You have to be willing to tell someone that, like, I know this will be effective because of this other thing that I've done or I've learned or I've seen or whatever. And so just giving people that permission is great from the company's point of view, but that route to it's okay when I'm wrong, that's all on that creative or that person, that marketer or whatever to do that themselves. So kind of just being supportive while people bumble around and like bump into walls and come back to you with bloody noses. So I think really like
because it's that thing, it's when somebody takes that risk, when someone takes that step for the first time, the second time, you know, the new member in your team or something, or you know, someone that's moving to a new level, you know, when someone speaks up, you know, it's on us, I think, as leaders within, you know, those creative teams to honor that risk that they've taken, to kind of honor that bravery and, you know, that positive reinforcement of, you know, not necessarily saying the idea is a good idea if it's not a good idea, but it's on us to absolutely make it okay to have that conversation and make them feel glad that they had that conversation and make it clear that we're glad that they had that conversation, right? It's about them doing it, but then when they do that, we've got to recognize that
100%, you know,
to remember what it was like to be that person.
100%. I mean, I heard about this creative director who used to do this thing in brainstorms where he'd purposely start the session off with a couple of bad ideas that he came up with, like just horrible ideas, just so that people in the room would be like, oh, that's a horrible idea. And they'd kind of like rip into it. And I've never tried that like advertently, but I sure have experienced that inadvertently. And so I think like a big role, like if you want people to have the courage of the convictions and to like come up with these ideas and air those ideas, it's incumbent on you to be doing the same thing in front of them and to be demonstrating to them that like, I can have a bad idea and defend that bad idea and then realize it was a bad idea. And the whole time I've done this, it may not be graceful, but I haven't stopped being me. And it's like, it's not like I can no longer come back to this brainstorm. I'm not like falling apart that this thing has fallen to pieces or whatever. Like I'm okay with the fact that I'm wrong. I'm okay with the fact that I'm learning here, and that's fine in this room. It's just a really important signal to send in an explicit, deliberate way, I think. And very often, like, that's just scary for me. Like, that's why it's hard for me to do that.
Because, you know, that's the thing for us as managers as well. I think you mentioned it earlier, it's this imposter syndrome, and it's the sense that, you know, we're leading these teams of talented people.
Exactly.
You know, and so it's like, oh, we have to justify that. and so it feels hard to be
that's
wrong
it.
For us too, but we've got to be willing
That's it. And it's magical to be like with the with Alice's kind of description of like, you know, conductors used to be really mean to the orchestra, and then the orchestra, like everyone was like, we should stop being mean to the orchestra, and then the orchestra started being mean to the conductor. That whole dynamic that's going, that is like, for me, in a way, that just looks like such a natural sequence of, instead of you being one of the people in this orchestra, you just happen to be doing hand stuff. What seems so enlightened about the way Alice kind of approaches this thing is that, like, no, I'm one of the 80 people here. I'm taking the same risks these guys are. I'm just with them in the same place taking those risks, as opposed to I am your lord and commander kind of, which I'm sure, I mean, I certainly grew up with a little bit of that in terms of the agencies I saw and grew up around. I'm sure you grew up with a little bit of that. Well, like, it used to be a very different thing to run an agency, and to like run a team in an agency. That Don Draper stuff, I don't think was that far off from the truth, unfortunately.
Harry, have you got any tips from your career that you've picked up about how to get the best out of creative people when you're making your content?
So, I think there are a million tips to get more from your creative talent. I think we've talked about a lot of the big ones, or the big issues that you're kind of wrestling with when you're doing this. I think the tip that I found most valuable, and no one ever said it explicitly to me, and this is learned behavior. I just saw it happen at Velocity when I joined. I saw that this was how Doug Kessler, who's the creative director at Velocity, did it. And everyone around him kind of had this thing they would do that I found really compelling. And I kind of roughly describe it as sacrificing your leverage, which is to say, if you hold a little bit of like, if someone feels like you hold some power over them, to just go in front of them and just surrender that power completely is such an incredibly trust creating thing. So for instance, if I've got a junior writer on my team and that junior writer is really scared that they're not going to finish their work on time because, you know, it's bad that you don't finish your work on time and you should finish your work on time. And then I'm coming up to them being like, yo, how's it going? A really valuable thing for me in that move is rather than coming down and them being like, what, you know, you gotta stay late and this is messed up and how could you do this and that kind of thing, which a lot of people, I guess, would do. The best move for me is to completely sacrifice the leverage I have over him. This idea that like, if he doesn't finish work on time, he's a bad guy. Just sacrifice and be like, dude, you couldn't finish on time? That sucks. That's bad. Sometimes, happens to me too. Don't worry about it. We'll deal with it tomorrow. Now, like, to a lot of people, that looks like, oh, that's kind of sissy talk, right? Like, you're allowing that person to do something stupid and get away with it. And what I'm doing is I'm saying, if you don't like the feeling of finishing your work on time, you should finish your work on time. But don't do it because I'm yelling at you or I'm like, that's no route to creativity. It has to be you having this thing. And so I haven't seen a lot of people talk about this thing, but I think I find it such a valuable, amazing, amazingly powerful thing you can do for free in any company, in any situation, is just go up to someone and say, hey, you know how you're worried I might do this thing to you? I'll tell you what, I'm not going to do it to you. Now what would you do? Right? And just see what comes out. That's creativity. What comes out next is creativity and definitely not like some kind of fear-based functional Frankenstein attempting to be an idea.
Cool. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you wanted particularly to say or to talk about? Have you got anything that you've got jotted down?
I'm looking at the words I've written down. Confidence, imposter syndrome, earned respect, wanting them to like you, disobedience, ignorance, not saying too much. I think, yeah? I think we did it, yeah.
Unbelievably, that's all we have time for this month. I told you, it goes quick, doesn't it? Thanks for joining me, Harry. I really hope you've enjoyed it.
Yes, it's been great, David. You are a genius, David. Thank you for having me, David. How kind and generous of you to it says all this on the script, by the way, guys. I don't know why David's making me say this. Some kind of narcissist. I don't know. This is weird. But no, seriously, this has been awesome, David. Thanks so much for having me. So much fun to talk about this stuff. Really chuffed you got to talk to Alice. That's amazing. And I'm still holding on to my dream that she's related to John Farnham. And there's a musical empire we don't know about.
Yeah, I think you might be wrong there. But yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Alice. Thanks to you, the listener, as well. Do remember, if you'd like to get in touch, you can send us a voice memo to podcast@radix-communications.com, or you can find us on Twitter @radixcom. Harry, if people want to get in touch with you, where's the best place for them to do that?
You can find me on Twitter. My handle is rupees, R-U-P-E-E-S, 1, the number, and then 100 spelled out, because I don't want you to find me on Twitter or something. this has just been my Twitter handle page. Just search for my name, Harendra Kapoor, H-A-R-E-N-D-R-A, K-A-P-U-R, and yeah, you'll find me there.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great to have you as a co-host.
It's been my pleasure, man. Thanks.
No, thank you. And until next time, listener, please stay safe, look after yourself and your loved ones, and remember, it'll all be all right in the end. And if it's not all right, it's not the end. Goodbye.